Campbell. But we've got it recording now. If anybody wants to record these lectures for their own personal use, they're very welcome to do that. Okay, magmatic rates. So, we have magmatism at mid-ocean ridges. We have intraplate volcanism. This can be large or small scale. Of course, what I haven't got up there is subduction and volcanism, volcano arcs. And we've got large igneous provinces. So we're going to look at a few factors of these. So I'm sorry this is terribly small. This figure is in my book, and I guess you've got handouts too. So if you want to, if you can't read it in the printed handouts, then it's in my book. There are a lot of e-copies of my book in the library. I think everyone could get one. There's some hard copies as well. But here I've drawn up various different sort of volcanic phenomena, and this is a histogram of the volumes. The rate, and that should be kilometres squared. I see there's a mistake there. It says kilometres per year. It should be kilometres cubed per year. So if we look at some of these things here, okay, I think nobody's chosen the Easter hotspot, but this is the volcanic rate at the Easter seamount chain. Let me see here now. This is the lower limit of volcanism in Iceland. This is the Emperor chain. So this is the Hawaiian chain from 80 to 50 million years. So this is the sort of older end of the two segments of the Emperor Hawaiian chain. This is the Hawaiian chain from the bend to 6 million years. Quite low here. This is Reunion. Not sure if anyone's saying Reunion. This is 100 kilometres of spreading plate boundary in Iceland. So if you take a look at the Hawaiian chain, for example, or any of the chains that other groups have chosen, you'll see that volcanism isn't just sort of a pinprick at one end, that it tends to be distributed. And in the case of Hawaii, volcanism is distributed over 100 or 200 kilometres. It's not just at the sharp end of the chain. So this is the volcanic rate of 100 kilometres of Iceland, and somewhere I've got calculated the volcanic rate of 100, you know, the whole of Hawaii, if you like. Okay, so here we have Hawaii 50 million years to 6 million years ago. Here we have Hawaii 6 million years to 2 million years. And here we have Hawaii 2 million years to the present. So you can see from this that the volcanic rate along the Hawaiian chain has not remained constant. It's ginormous now, and it was very small at some other times, and it was the intermediate rate at other times. okay, so you can take a look at that, see if there's something of relevance to your hotspot. Here in these pink bars, we've got theoretical modelling. So Professor Campbell's group, I introduced you to Professor Campbell last week. Could somebody open a couple of windows at the back here before you'll die of heat stroke? Thank you. Professor Campbell, in addition to talking about uplift and doing things like that, has published lots and lots of papers on theoretical aspects of plumes. And I took these pink bars from a theoretical paper that his group worked on, where they did a numerical analysis. Okay, they numerically set up an experiment in the computer. They heated up the bottom of the mantle. They let a plume rise, and the plume head form. So As material rises through the deep mantle, the pressure is too great for extensive melting to occur. As material rises up, very little melting, none at all, we can assume, occurs until you get to about 200 kilometres depth. And then the material has decompressed enough so melting begins. And to begin with, you get really rather little melting. And then if the material rises up to 100 kilometres, you start to get more melting. But you get the most melting if it rises almost up to the surface. So you can imagine if a plume impinges on the bottom of a thick continental lithosphere, which is 200 kilometres thick, you'll get very little melting occurring there. You won't get the large igneous province. But if this plume impinges on a mid-ocean ridge and it rises right up to, say, 5 or 6 kilometres below the surface, you get a tremendous lot of melt. That's what the theory predicts. That's what the theory predicts, and what we have to do as geologists and geophysicists is to go out there and see if the predictions are fulfilled. And here I've graphed up for you the sort of quantities you'd is for a theoretical plume that impinged upon lithosphere 100 kilometres thick. This is 25 kilometres thick, and this is how much you would get if it impinged on a mid-ocean ridge and the crust was only, the lithosphere was only 6 kilometres thick. So the shallower it can rise, the more melt you get. This blue thing, on the other hand, is the size of large igneous provinces. And note that there's a little arrow here saying times 5. So that's probably somewhere up on the roof. Well, I don't know, not quite sure how tall the roof space is. But it's way up above the ceiling here is the volumes, the volume rates that are erupted in large igneous provinces. So you know, the point is this can't be explained just simply with this simple vanilla plume model.
People have, of course, have adapted the plume model, and people have come up with different models to try to explain this.
We're talking about this soon. Okay, thickness of oceanic crust. We tend to say, you know, the oceanic crust is 6 kilometres thick. Everyone knows. If somebody says to you, everyone knows, then you should immediately ask yourself, is that correct? It's probably not correct. When people say everyone knows, they mean that nobody has actually stood back and reflected, is this correct? Okay. So, this particular worker did, and they searched through the literature, and they found as many estimates of the thickness of the oceanic crust as they could, and plotted up this histogram here. So, most estimates are this is 6 or 7. Ballpark, I think this is 7 kilometres thick. So the most popular, measured thickness of oceanic crust is 7 kilometres. But there are lots of reports of oceanic crust as thin as 1 kilometre, and we now know that along some spreading plate boundaries, the crust is 0 kilometres thick. The plate boundary is spreading, and it's just mantle peridotite that's rising up, and no melting is occurring, so there's no basalt being formed. And there are instances of much, much thicker crust, and even up to 37 kilometres thick. And I myself have done work in Iceland, and we think Iceland is a complicated place, but if you take the seismic wave speeds and you say everything below about 7.3 kilometres per second is crust, we're not sure about that, but if you said that, you would get 42 kilometres as the maximum thickness under Iceland, which of course is on a spreading plate boundary. So, here's another interesting point which people can reflect on, especially people who are taking as their example oceanic Pacific chains. I think some group taking the Samoa chain, for example. So this is quite a puzzle, and nobody really fully understands this. Here we have the age of the crust at the time the seamount was in place. And here we have a proxy for the volume of the seamount. And what this is saying is that the older the crust on which an eruption occurs, the seamount is built, the bigger the seamount. So, you know, initially people say, oh, well, obviously the older the crust, the older the lithosphere, the stronger it is, so it can support a bigger seamount. But that doesn't explain why you get a bigger seamount. Why don't you get big seamounts on the young crust? And okay, the crust might warp down and, goodness knows, maybe very loaded, and all sorts of interesting things might happen. But you just don't get those big seamounts on a very thin crust. So why is that? Nobody has really come up with a satisfactory explanation that I know of. So if somebody can squirrel one up that sounds convincing, then I shall put it in the second edition of my book and acknowledge the person who... Okay, let's look at one particular volcanic region, Iceland, where the thickness of the amount of melt, the amount of melt varies a lot. So, here we have Iceland, here we have the spreading plate boundary. Now, this is a very interesting area. I worked for the University of Iceland for 7 years and lived in Reykjavik. So I spent 7 years of my life studying Iceland, various aspects, including seismology and geothermal and volcanic activity, and also we pioneered GPS surveying there and measured the motion of the plate boundaries using GPS surveying. We were the first group to do that. So let's take a look at the bigger picture here. Here we have the Rakeness Ridge. A little bend in it there. Here we have the Charlie Gibbs fracture zone. One interesting thing about this is that the spreading is not orthogonal to the plate boundary. The plate boundary is in this direction, if you like, and spreading is in this direction. So it's an obliquely opening plate boundary, and this is extremely unusual. You can see that there aren't any transform faults along here, because obviously a transform fault wouldn't work. A transform fault only works if you have orthogonal spreading. Okay, here we have a big mess of where Iceland is, and north of Iceland, the plate boundary shoots off in a completely different direction. So something weird is happening at Iceland, so there's a big kink in the plate boundary there. This is also, you know, an extremely unusual thing to observe. There aren't many places where, you know, the plate boundary just suddenly changes direction and it's all covered up and you can't see what's going on. In actual fact, there are several triple junctions under Iceland, and it's all very complicated. But it's even more complicated than that. We have a second spreading plate boundary here. This is an extinct plate boundary. This is the currently active one. And we have a complicated transform up here. This is the island of Jan Mayen, and we have the Mons Ridge going up there. So Iceland's not just like a sort of regular plate boundary with a big blob of magma on it. It's very complicated tectonically. Basalt, young basalt, covers everything, and so like Hawaii, it's quite difficult to study. There's obviously a lot more fancy stuff underneath the surface than there is on the surface, and I'll explain that in a minute or two. So these are volcanic margins. When the North Atlantic split open at 54 million years, there was a tremendous burst of volcanism. And so-called volcanic margins with so-called seaward dipping reflectors, buzzwords for the Iceland group, were built along this margin and this margin as well. And then the thing started spreading. But volcanism at this point was perpetually enhanced. Okay. So the Iceland-Faroes Ridge, this is made of sort of similar material to Iceland. It appears to be thick. Ocean crust. It appears to be ocean crust about 30 kilometres thick. The only snag is it can't be, but crust 30 kilometres thick, because isostatic calculations show that it would stick 3 or 4 kilometres up above sea level if it was. So under Iceland, we've measured thicknesses of this slow material, this crust-like material, of up to 42 kilometres, but if that was all basaltic crust, Iceland would stand 4 kilometres high, and it doesn't, it only stands 1 kilometre high. So much of this seismic thickness, which many people just say, oh, that's crust, you know, it can't be crust as we know it, it's got to be something much denser. That's another puzzle for anybody who's interested. Nobody has yet explained what this stuff is that's got a seismic wave speed of about 7.2, but seems to have a density close to that of peridotite mantle. I've got some ideas how to look into this. If anybody's interested in a project, and that's another puzzle that just needs a little bit of squirreling around, and might find something interesting. Okay, what I'm going to show you now is a bathymetric profile from way down south of the Azores. That's down near in the floor below somewhere, to a way up somewhere in the roof space. And here we have it. Okay, so here we have distance in thousands of kilometres. So this is from 0 to 6,000 kilometres. This is a long stretch of ridge. And here we have depth of the sea floor. Here's Iceland sticking up above the surface. As you can see, this is 1 kilometre here. So apart from one or two higher mountains, the sort of broad, smooth dome of Iceland is about 1 kilometre high, a few peaks slightly higher than that. And here we have the Iceland shelf, the shoulders here. And here we have the spreading plate boundary going all the way down to the mid-Atlantic. And then we go back up again here, and here are the Azores. So one or two little tiny islands, of course, sticking above the surface. Very nice islands, go there if you can. been a nightmare journey to get there, but it's worth it at the end. and then it gets deeper again. And north of Iceland, on the Mons Ridge, it gets deeper. So we look at these pictures of Iceland and say, wow, you know, look at that island there. It's a really special thing. But in fact, Iceland is just really the tip of a huge dome about 3,000 kilometres broad. And Iceland just sort of happens to tip above sea level. So if there was a bit more water on Earth, you know, Iceland wouldn't tip above sea level. It would be obviously shallow. But, you know, I sometimes wonder how we would view Iceland if it didn't just coincidentally sort of happen to stick up above sea level, because it's really just part of this huge global feature. Okay, this was produced by my group, who did a lot of seismic work in Iceland, receiver functions, if you want to know the detail. Papers describing this can be found on my publications page on my website. And let's see, here we have crustal thickness. So this is 20 kilometres thick, this is 40 kilometres thick, and here's what it looks like over Iceland. So over here in the west, obviously that's where it's thinnest. 20 something kilometres, much of this, and this is a little bit thicker over in the east. And here in the middle, we appear to have this unusual blob here, this round blob here, which seems to be much thicker. So there are two sort of ideas as to what this could be. One is that it's a plume stem, of course, but as if it was a plume stem, you'd expect to see thick stripes going in both directions, because stuff is spreading all the time. You just see this one thing. And the other is that it's a submerged microplate in the style of the Easter microplate. Have you been taught about the Easter microplate? Okay, I'll tell you a little bit about it. Professor Searle, who is now emeritus, he studied this region. But the trouble with saying it's a submerged microplate is that we don't actually have samples of it. This is theoretical. This would need to be tested. So there's problems with both these models. This is the tectonic evolution of Iceland, and I'll leave the Iceland group to look into this. This picture appears in a number of places. But the basic message is that if you take modern-day Iceland now, the interesting thing about it is that this is the 15-million-year isochron, and this is the 15-million-year isochron over here, so this far apart. But if you look on the Reykjanes Ridge, the 15-million-year isochrons are much closer together, like this. The spreading rate is 2 centimetres per year. So in 15 million years, you can calculate how much spreading has occurred. Can somebody tell me, at 2 centimetres a year, 15 million years, how many kilometres of spreading does that give you? I don't see everyone pouncing on their calculators. How many? How many?
300.
300 kilometres, yes, that's correct. 300 kilometres. So in 15 million years, this amount of ocean floor would be built, 2 centimetres a year for 15 million years. Okay, if you go to the north here, you see that these 15 million year things are, isochrons, they're 450 kilometres apart. So can somebody say what this tells us? It could be faster, yes. So do you think the spreading is 2 centimetres a year here, 2 centimetres a year here, and 4 centimetres a year here? Yes.
Could they have been displaced a bit more through faulting?
That's another suggestion, but that suggestion cannot explain. It could explain why things were in an odd place, but it couldn't explain why there's 450 kilometres of breadth there, and only 300 there. Yes. That's right, yes. Well done. You know, I noticed this about sort of, I don't know, 8 years ago, and I thought, wow, you know, I've never heard anyone point that out before. So I wrote it up quickly and sent it for publication, and
took me about 9 months to convince people. They just simply couldn't believe it. But it's required. It's required by the observations. This is a very short paper I published, so if you're interested, you can have a look. But there's no other explanation. If the spreading was faster, you'd see major deformations and evidence for that elsewhere in the geology, which is not seen. And if the ridges had migrated about, which, as you say, Ryan, that was until I sort of pointed this out, that was the most popular theory. Everybody went with that. You still would not explain why there's more. You know, if the ridges had jumped around, you might find a 15 million year isochron here and it much closer on one side, but it wouldn't explain why there's more expanse. So the material in the middle has to be older. In order to produce 450 kilometres at 2 centimetres a year, it takes more than 15 million years. How long does it take?
35.
How many?
35.
If you've got 300 kilometres in 15 million years, how long would it take to form 450? 22.5, thank you, Zach, yes. Take 22.5 kilometres. So there must be material here which is older than 15 million years. But there's no sampling from the surface being done of anything that's older than 15 million years in Iceland. So this stuff, if it exists, if this is correct, it must be submerged under much younger lavas. So I think that's exciting. So here we have the Easter chain. I think nobody is taking the Easter hotspot. There's not a huge amount published, so that was a wise decision by you all. This is not terribly clear either, but down the East Pacific Rise, we've got a lot of so-called overlapping spreading centres, and this is where the ridge is kind of like this. The ridge will go south, and it will sort of curve around in a hook like this, and then it sort of takes over from this next one, which is displaced to one side, and it continues on further south. And sometimes these things propagate up and down the ridge. So it's a really sort of weird, complicated form of spreading. And at ESA, you've got a so-called rotating microplate. There's quite a big hook here. Instead of it being quite close together and only maybe 5 kilometres between the two, I can't remember how much it is, but it's of the order of tens of kilometres. Check that, somebody can check that up. And it's a more or less static situation like this. So this thing is expanding in a fan-like fashion. This ridge is kind of opening like this. And this one over here is opening in a complementary way, and it's causing the bit in between to rotate. So it's called a rotating microplate. And I'll be giving you a web link later on where you can kind of see an animation of this on somebody's website. And then there are these chains on either side. So one hypothesis is that there's a mantle plume under here and that this is causing time-progressive volcanism, because this volcanism is quite time-progressive. This has not been sampled, so we don't know if that's time-progressive or not. Okay, so this is where the submerged microplate theory comes from, or you might prefer the plume theory if you advocate that theory. The chevron ridges, this is an interesting feature south of Iceland, and for a long time I really had no answer to this. So this is a gravity map of the region south of Iceland, and the red is high gravity, indicating thick oceanic crust, and the blue is lower gravity, indicating a smaller thickness of oceanic crust. So, as you can see, here's the ridge, this black line, and as you go out, the crust is thick, thin, thick, thin, thick, thin. So, but if you actually measure the age, if you take one of these red stripes and you measure the age of it all the way along, you find it gets younger and younger as you go further south. So these are called diachronous ridges, meaning they're cutting across time. They're also called chevron ridges, because the person who first discovered them, Peter Vogt, was working for the US Navy, so of course he was into this military kind of insignia. Chevron is one of the stripes that military people have on their sleeves. They've had some rank.
And anyway, so there again, there are two theories for these. And until quite recently, the only theory around was that there was a plume under Iceland. It was pulsing, and these pulses were sort of barreling down the Reykjanes Ridge like a bowling ball in a gutter. My bowling balls never go in the gutter because I don't bowl. Okay, and as this sort of ball of extra hot material rolled down, that it caused a little bit extra thicker crust to form. So this would explain why, as you go further down, the thicker crust is sort of younger and younger. However, a gentleman called Richard Hay then went and studied this, and he came up with another theory. So Richard Hay is Mr. Propagating Ridge. Here we have a simple schematic of this process I just described to you. There we have one ridge here, which is propagated south, getting longer and longer south, and this is a failing rift, and the tip of this rift is just propagating south, if you like. So you've got these two rifts like this, and the whole thing is just propagating. This one is sort of taking over. And he studied these a lot because there are lots and lots of them on the East Pacific Rise. And if you look at what happens here, you find that as this rift propagates south, it's slicing a piece of crust off, which used to be on this plate, and it's transferring it to that plate. Okay. So, for example, here we've got the old, here we've got the rift that's dying, and this slice of material here, this is on the eastern plate, and it's obviously going to be moving off in this direction if this ridge carries on. But if this ridge zooms past, it's going to slice that off, and it's transferred that to the western plate. So one aspect of these things is that you get this kind of disturbed pattern of seafloor, disturbed bathymetric pattern, and it's thicker on one side than it is on the other. Richard Hay calls these pseudo faults, because it's kind of a line which separates the disturbed and messed up bathymetry from the smooth, undisturbed bathymetry. So, whoops. So here's his web page, and if you go to his actual personal web page, which is here, then you can click and you can see animations of these things happening. So Richard Hay goes to the Reykjanes Ridge when he retires. He thinks, oh, I'm retired now, I don't have to teach undergraduates, I can go off and do some research. So he sails off to Reykjanes Ridge on a research cruise there, and they find propagating ridges. They do some surveying, and he starts seeing propagating ridges, and he thinks, so, you know, what is this? He told me about this, so I can tell you what he said. He was quite puzzled about this, because he said, well, these can't be propagators, there must be something going wrong, because if they were propagators, we'd have a thick, you know, a much wider area of disturbed rift on one side than on the other, and somebody would have noticed that. So when he got back to his lab, he pulled out a map, and he found it was true, and nobody had noticed it before, because nobody had looked. So, if you go to his web page, he wrote us a web page which he calls Disclosure, and it's worth a read. It's a human element in it. Okay, so I think there's a group taking the Galapagos, is that correct? Yep. So, I think the Galapagos is sort of gobsmackingly similar to Iceland. Here we have a spreading ridge here, there's a transform fault here and a spreading ridge here. So this is the same as Iceland. Iceland's got two transform faults in it, and these propagating ridges that I showed you south of Iceland, there are also some north of Iceland. They're not so well developed. You can see the little black marks here, but there's some red and blue and red and blue and red. And there are a number of papers out there describing these so-called diachronous ridges north of Iceland, although they're not so well developed. But we do have the same thing at the Galapagos. These propagators are causing these sort of diachronous acronyms, the pseudo faults and not diachronous ridges. They have not really been, they're not so prominent here as they are south of Iceland. In Iceland they sort of slap you in the face, but nobody has really sort of emphasised those here. I haven't looked carefully myself, but somebody should do that. Here we have a thick ridge of crust, and here we have another thick ridge of crust, the Cocos Ridge and the Carnegie Ridge. So from this part of the Cocos Nazca spreading segment, it's been sort of perpetually overproductive, and the seafloor that's formed from this sort of region here, the oceanic crust that's formed, is somewhat thicker than elsewhere. So as the material has, you know, the plates are moving in this sort of direction like this, so as they form, you've got these ridges of thickened crust. So this is very analogous to Iceland too. If I get time, I'm going to look into this in more detail and write a paper comparing and contrasting Iceland and the Galapagos. So there's another project there if somebody's interested. So many projects. And the Galapagos are really just the currently most active patch on this ridge pair. And there again, it sticks up above the sea like Iceland does. But you can see that there's been other times when there was enhanced volcanism too. And there are quite a lot of islands around here. And there's a web page on the website where the age dating, there was some recently, some extensive age dating was done around here. And the people who did that wrote us a web page too, so hit that web page and it's all there on a plate for you. Okay, plug on. Hawaii. Here we have the Hawaiian chain, the Great Bend at 50 million years. And the Emperor chain, which terminates at the older end here, which is 80 million years, with Detroit Seamount. This is the volcanic rates along the Emperor and Hawaii chains for the Hawaii group. It's all on the website, and all the original papers are cited there. So here's 80 million years, and this is 0 million years. This is taken from an old piece of work. People have measured the volumes of the islands and they've calculated what the volcanic rate was all along. So you can see that from 80 to 50, the Emperor chain, it's approximately 0.01 cubic kilometres per year. Then just after the bend, it kind of falls through the floor and becomes extremely low and kind of almost switches off. And then it surges back up again and it's twice as great. Oh yes. Practically twice as great, so it's 0.017 cubic kilometres per year. But then in the last 5 million years, it shot up to 0.05. So in the last 5 million years, according to this older work, it's been 5 times as great as it ever was in the past. If we expand this 5 million years, and this was done by the US Geological Survey recently, they actually looked in tremendous detail just at this last few million years. This is what they find. They find from 6 to 2 million years, it's down at this level here. So it's down at this level. It's about the level of the Emperor chain from 6 to 2 million years. And then from 2 million years to present, it's just simply gone through the roof. So this huge current activity that we look Hawaii, and we're so impressed by this tremendous volcanism. It's really just the last 2 million years. Prior to that, there were quite small volume seamounts. So obviously, any theory has to explain why these variations occur. Okay, let's quickly gallop through the rest because I see that I'm being long-winded. The definition of a large igneous province is a basaltic volcanic area larger than 100,000 square kilometres in area. So, I think that's a sensible definition to give some impression of the size of an area. I think it's pretty dumb myself because if you have a flood basalt eruption, then the area over which it spreads is dependent on the topography. So So if you've got a flood basalt eruption, say, in the East African Rift, where it was all contained by the sides of the rift, it would cover a much smaller area than if it was erupted in the middle of the Sahara Desert, where everything is pancake flat. So, but this is the definition. Okay. So when we talk about large igneous provinces, it's a good idea to know what it is exactly we're talking about. And if you go upstairs and you walked all the way from one office down to the other and you stuck your head in each staff room door, probably wouldn't get to the end before you were thrown out, and you said to the staff member inside, what's the definition of a large igneous province? You would probably get 25 different definitions. But this is the original published definition. Here we have them. The largest terrestrial, the largest oceanic one is the Ontong Java Plateau. The largest one on land is the Siberian Traps. Okay, that's what they look like, just huge thicknesses of basalt, much of it not studied in detail. The Siberian Traps has got a volume of about 10 million cubic kilometres and it's the size of Australia. Imagine a flood basalt province the size of Australia. This is the time scale of eruption. So here we have 40 million years. Here we have the Permian-Triassic boundary. So this, most of the Siberian Traps, say 9 million cubic kilometres, was, I see the scale's fallen off the slide, was erupted pretty quickly as a gigantic burst of volcanism. So 9 million cubic kilometres of stuff was erupted just within 1 million years. But volcanism did actually last a longer period than that. Here is an actual plot of data to underpin what I said earlier, that material has to rise very shallow in order to produce large volumes. So this again is from Professor Campbell's theoretical modelling paper, the first author of which is Cordery, who I presume is a PhD student. So here we have lithospheric age, which is a proxy for thickness. So lithosphere of this sort of age is 100 or 200 kilometres thick, something like this. And this is lithosphere of zero thickness, which of course is spreading plate boundary. And here we have a graph which shows plume that's risen up. This plume has got an excess temperature of 300 degrees. It's risen up, it's impacted the base of the lithosphere, it's decompressed, full melt, and this melt has erupted. Okay, it's got a 300 degree temperature anomaly. Now, if it impacted on lithosphere that was 1 or 200 kilometres thick, such as the Siberian Traps, the numerical modelling predicts that you would get about 1 million cubic kilometres. That would be the maximum you could get because the material couldn't rise any higher. The North Atlantic volcanic province is 5 million cubic kilometres, the Siberian Traps is 10. So obviously this underpredicts. Something else must be happening. If a plume impacted on something that was, say, 20 kilometres thick, you would expect to get up to about 8 million cubic kilometres. And if it came up underneath a spreading ridge, you would get up to 12, according to this standard theory. The Ontong Java Plateau's got a volume of about 60 million cubic kilometres, and the published literature is currently debating whether, in fact, the Ontong Java Plateau broke up into two or three plateaus, and if you put them all back together, it's 100 million. So you can see that this theory can explain small flood basalts, like the Columbia River basalts, Yellowstone group, but it can't explain these big ones, either a thick lithosphere or thin lithosphere. So, the melt as you erupt scenario, if you're melting on the same time scale that you're erupting, you cannot explain these tremendous flood basalts which erupted very quickly. The melt has to form over a longer period of time than it erupted. That's the bottom line. So here we have a summary of suggested ways of producing melt. Here's the plume. The plume comes up, decompresses, melts, and the stuff erupts as it melts. Here we have the theory that the bottom of the lithosphere can become very dense and it can drop off delamination. So I think I showed you a little video of this before. So if this happens, it sort of drips off like this, then hot material will rush up into the gap and will melt and erupt. And people have suggested in the case of the plume scenario that when a plume comes up, then maybe it's eroding away the base of the lithosphere. So the lithosphere is becoming thinner and thinner and the plume is moving higher and higher up, and that's how you can get more melt. So this is called lithospheric erosion. The lithospheric erosion could help the plume theory. Delamination is a way of getting melt further up as well. Some people have even suggested that there's evidence for a delamination and that the plume has caused this to occur. Hybrid models. And then there's a theory that you can have melting in the mantle over a long period of time. This stuff can sort of percolate up. It can pond at the base of the lithosphere. And then if you have an orogenic event which puts the lithosphere into extension, then this pre-existing pond can empty all at once and just all come up to the surface at once. And there's a paper out there which studies southern African large igneous provinces, and they've got xenolith data. Okay, so this is a really clever experiment. They looked at xenoliths that came up in kimberlite pipes before the flood basalts and after. And from these xenoliths, they've got an estimate of lithospheric thickness before and after. And they present their work saying that the lithosphere was very thick both before and after. So there was no delamination, there was no erosion, and they say the only explanation is that there must have been a pond of melt which just drained all at once when the lithosphere went into extinction. So there's all this sweet theories, and what your job in looking at your hotspots is that you've got to find as much evidence as you can and try to falsify all these theories. You've got to try and falsify as many of these suggestions as you can. We're not trying to prove something. We're not trying to say this is consistent with that theory. That doesn't really tell us anything at all. That's just, you know, probably worth saying. What we want to do is try and rule something out so we narrow the possibilities. Okay, I think I'll... I've got to the end of my slides, so I'll let you have your 10-minute break now. Then Richard will come in and give a short address, and then I'll show you a few more slides, and then you can get on with your studies.